everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Jim Banner and John Gillis on the show, and we'll be talking about their new book, Becoming Historians. The book is a series of memoirs by historians who were born around World War II, and it concerns generally how they chose to become historians and the progress of their careers. It's a fascinating read for those of you who read a lot of history, because you probably wonder how historical careers are made. I know that in my own case, my historical career, such as it is, was a complete accident. I was assigned an advisor at Grinnell College who whipped me into shape and helped me along the way. There are a lot of stories like this in Becoming Historians, and I think that you'll find them interesting. There's also a lot of food for thought for those of you who are interested in generational differences in American historiography. The generation that Jim and John belong to, that is roughly came of age in the 1950s and 1960s, is very different, actually, than the generation that followed it and the generation that is currently in training to enter the academy and to write history. And we talked a little bit about some of those differences. As you can tell, I really enjoyed talking to Jim and John today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, John and Jim.
Hello, Marshall.
Hello, Marshall.
How are you guys today?
Fine, thanks.
Good. This is our first ever conference call interview on New Books in History, and I'd like to tell our listeners that we have John is in California, and Jim is on the East Coast, and I am in the Midwest. So we are taking full advantage of modern technology. And if it doesn't work, it's not my fault. It's somebody else's. And Skype, we'll say it's Skype's fault. Anyway, we'll be talking with John Gillis and Jim Banner today about their terrific new book, Becoming Historians, and I read the book with great interest because it's about a cohort of historians born around World War II. Would that be a fair characterization, around World War II?
Yes, a few years either side.
Yeah, and how they chose to enter the profession. And so it's both historical in the sense that you can see the discipline as it was becoming, I think I could actually say, as it was becoming a serious discipline in the United States, and this cohort of people is responsible for that, I would say. And you can also learn a little bit about why people in general choose to become historians. One of the things that I realized while I was reading the book is that almost nobody, at least in the book, and nobody in my experience, grew up wanting to become a historian, really. I mean, an astronaut or a professional baseball player or something like that, yes, but historian, not really. And so it's an acquired taste, and this book goes a long way in explaining how it is acquired by 9 historians, and it'll be 11 historians, including the interviewees today. So let me begin in our customary fashion by asking first John Gillis to tell us a little bit about himself, his Lebenslauf, as the Germans say. I just love that word.
Yep. Well, curiously enough, I started out in German history, so
there you go.
But left it behind. I should say that I don't remember history being on the aptitude list that we were tested for, but I fell into history, I think as Edward Thompson once put it, I was seized by history, as Edward was, and I was really seized by history when I was spent a year in England and came in under the spell, this magical spell of the history workshop movement, and moved on to be a British social historian, and then subsequently I've done various iterations of that and family history and history of age groups and memory and now I've moved on to global history. So I'm a professional trespasser. I can't sit still very long, and so I've moved across time and space multiple times, hopefully to my benefit. Certainly to my benefit, and hopefully to the benefit of history.
Mm-hmm. Jim, why don't you go ahead?
Well, neither was I seized of history, although I was always drawn to it as an undergraduate. And I was going to be an attorney and had been admitted to law schools, but then I went abroad in the Army, which is something that people of my age could do and could do, fortunately, safely in the 1950s and very early 1960s. And it was in service in the Army, and particularly 2 years I spent in the Army in France, that I became very, very interested in the history of that nation and concerned about my comparative ignorance, although I'd been studying it as an undergraduate for some years, about the history of my own country. And I decided from France to apply to graduate school in American history, and then went to Columbia and ended up on the Princeton faculty, where John and I met each other in 1966. And since then, for 15 years, I think I was a historian in decently good standing. And then I left to try to provide some new resources for the humanities by setting up a new organization, which was domiciled here in Washington. And unfortunately, I had to resign my professorship at Princeton, and I came here to Washington, and that didn't work out. But I stayed here and pursued other things, and have over the years maintained decent bona fides as a historian. I'm now at a somewhat advanced age, back doing a great deal of history, but from a kind of a slant. I'm spending a lot of time thinking about the state and the circumstances and the health of the discipline, and how to prepare historians, and what can be done to strengthen history, which is quite strong to begin with, but to strengthen it even further in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let me just begin a discussion of the book by asking, and I'd ask you to draw on all of the memoirs if you can. What was the historical discipline like from the perspective of, let's first ask from the perspective of a high school student in, I don't know, I guess it would be the late 40s, early 50s, and then from the perspective of a college student. How did you think about, or how did the historians that wrote memoirs think about history, or did they think about it at all at that time period, early in their careers?
John, you go ahead. You're good.
All right, I'll start. I think, to say the least, except for a few institutions, of which Jim may have attended one of them, history teaching at the high school level was totally uninspired in the 50s and even into the 60s and unfortunately probably beyond that. So that college was the great eye-opening moment for most of the people in our book. All of them were in some way inspired by the teachers they encountered. All of them, by the way, almost all of them were at liberal arts colleges, and found the teaching to be extremely engaging. All of them, I think, were shaped in one way or another by one college teacher or another. And it was that that propelled them to go on to graduate study, which turned out, as we'll see, to be very, very different from their experience in the college ranks.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you have anything to add there?
Well, no, I agree. I happened to attend both public and private school before college, and the teaching was quite pedestrian. And in fact, I've always been puzzled by the fact that the person who taught me American history at a private boarding school that I attended was really a ghastly teacher. He was a lovely man and entirely well-meaning, but in effect he had us memorize the textbook. And I overcame that, and I've thought that it must have been some fit, and I emphasize this always when talking with people about why we do anything. It must have been some fit between my own disposition and that man, because at least he made me see how important the history of our own nation was to him and why it is that I should also think of it as important and pay attention to it. Beyond that, the teaching was awful, and it was only when I was sort of released into the excitement of a university college that I came upon history as it's much more closely thought of today as a discipline with all different kinds of subjects and personalities and approaches and everything else.
Mm-hmm. No, my experience is quite consistent with yours, even across 25 years, I would say, in that I wouldn't say that my teachers in junior high and high school were exactly inspiring. I did have one, however, who did, and I'll never forget him, did pique my interest, and his name was Mr. Mader. And the thing that he did that other teachers of history did not was he had a very keen sense of irony. I remember he called someone, I don't know, the Archduke Ferdinand, or I don't know who it was, a toady. And I remember thinking, that was the funniest thing I ever heard. I didn't really know what toady meant, but it sounded extraordinarily funny. And I used to talk to him about these things, and he had real opinions about history. And that was important for me, because he took stances, and sometimes they were critical and sometimes not. But nonetheless, it did sort of draw me a little bit, but it was really more to his personality than it was the subject itself, I would say. But I think you're quite right. I mean, having read all of the memoirs, none of them really point back with, well, there's a possible exception of Joan Wallach Scott. I think she mentioned some high school teachers. I don't think that high school was really the thing that grabbed people. It was college. And I was interested to hear you say that it was the kind of teaching that was done in these colleges that grabbed people, as you put it. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, I quite agree ahead.
I should say something about this. I think there's a certain bliss in ignorance, and I think I remember quite explicitly teaching it in the 60s and 70s, and feeling that it was a great advantage to be a college teacher, because our students were arriving so unprepared, and we could astonish them with certain kinds of knowledge that they had never encountered, make of ourselves much better teachers than we probably were, simply by the fact that they were arriving in such an unformed state. So I think probably that is true again today, that people can teach students things that probably they shouldn't actually take much credit for, because the preparation is so poor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suspect that goes with many subjects too. But it's also that college and university teachers can risk things with their students that is probably imprudent for high school teachers to do. And mm-hmm. they can have fun with the material that high school teachers can try to have, but it may not work with their students.
Yeah. I mean, I can say that my mother was a junior high school teacher, and you know, she had to teach five classes a day, so how she could enliven each of those classes with a spark of brilliance or wit or anything, I don't know. She had to raise me and my sister, too, so that was quite something for her. But let's go back to this topic of teachers at liberal arts colleges, because it's one that I'm very interested in, because my thesis would be that the creation of the modern research university, of which I am a part, has led to a real diminution in the reduction in the quality of teaching. I would say my teaching is not nearly as good as the instruction that I got at Grinnell College just down the road, and I'll talk about that in a second. But maybe you could respond to that.
Well, let me start on this. First of all, in those olden times, graduate study was not as developed, and I don't think most of the people who taught me had any thought that they would be teaching graduate students. So they poured all their energies and their aspirations into the undergraduates that they were teaching. And I think for them, teaching good, bright undergraduates at Amherst College, where I went, was a wholly satisfactory career. That may have accounted for the kind of some of the excellence and attention that we got, that perhaps today, where the aspirations lie elsewhere. And I think actually it's a rather tragic situation where people think that, oh, you know, I can only have a wonderful career in history if I move on to a major research university where I'll have all these graduate students. Well, you know, that is really an illusion. That's not where most people's love of teaching comes from. It doesn't come from a graduate seminar. It usually is generated in some kind of undergraduate setting.
Mm-hmm.
I would second fully what John has said. I found more satisfying teaching younger people, the undergraduates, than the graduate students. But I'd also point out, again, as to contextualize a little bit what John has already said, that when he and I went to college, whether it was at an Amherst college or like yourself, Marshall, at Grinnell, or like myself at Yale in what I'd call it a university college, the faculty members could all count on a certain agreement among themselves as to what their aims were. And those aims were all focused on turning out well-rounded young men and women who knew a lot of subjects, not terribly deeply, but quite broadly. So they came out informed, able to read the newspaper intelligently, become good citizens, and not worry about whether they were going to get their jobs or not. Now, another thing it's very important to bear in mind is that John and I graduated from college at a time when jobs were plentiful, when it was peacetime. After all, those of us who were born when I was in 1935 were members of probably the smallest age, the smallest population cohort in the 20th century. So when we came out of college, there was less competition, and yet there were all of these new young people who had been born after the Second World War. And we have gone through our lives serving a much larger group of people than we entered with. And so we've had extraordinary fortune in being able to find the kind of occupation and the kind of fulfillments that we could design for ourselves. Those who came after us by 10 or 15 years just did not have that luck.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's precisely right. I can recall very vividly sort of looking over the CVs, really, of the people who taught me at Berkeley in graduate school. And I hope you don't mind my saying, but it's absolutely true that if you compare the publication record of someone in my cohort with theirs, they look very thin. And I think that's because, first of all, there was a kind of, there was less competition, but there was also there was a notion that teaching was an extraordinarily important part of what they did. And while I would say that teaching is an important part of what I do and what people in my cohort do, it has lessened in importance because, you know, we have the, and I believe this is true everywhere all over America now, that there are the three things that you have to do: service, teaching, and research. And the fact of the matter is, at major research universities, only really one of them counts very much toward the big prize, and everybody knows that when they get here. Actually, one of the phrases that I think it was Jim used about Princeton was it had a reputation even in the 50s of being kind of a revolving door. Now, every place is a revolving door if you don't produce. You will be, you know, if you don't have a book at the end of your fourth year on a tenure track job, you may get the opportunity to pursue another career, and that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on people. I mean, that's if you get a job at all, which is tough.
Well, to go back to our generation, the liberal arts college in those days was its own self-contained universe. I think this was Jim's point. And most of our professors were content to flourish within that universe. And they really didn't have a horizon beyond that. And they didn't convey much of a horizon. I don't remember having any extended conversations about graduate school, what it would be like. Now, that may have been exclusive to me, but I think it wasn't. I think that most of our professors were content to think that if they had transformed us during those 4 years and we went on, that was fine. But we never got that proto-professional polishing that undergraduates do today. In other words, today identified as bright undergraduate will be groomed, will be they'll already be thinking of their first publication, their first conference paper by the time they graduate from undergraduate school. And this sets up an entirely different environment at the undergraduate level. Less free, I think, to experiment and explore what we were probably allowed to do.
Yeah, that was that notion was passing out of existence when I applied to graduate school. I remember very vividly the essay that I wrote for graduate school, and it said basically that I wanted to study history. That was pretty much all I said. And now that I've been on, admission committee, people are extraordinarily specific about what they want to study. They've already written a senior thesis that's on, the Russian bureaucracy in the 1920s, and they want to pursue that in an MA and thesis work. I simply was interested in history and wanted to study history, and that, yeah, well, I think people scratched their head when they saw my essay. But I don't know. Yeah, but I think that's passed away. I do like the formulation that you proffered there about a kind of universe in and of itself, because I know Grinnell was like that. We didn't look beyond Poweshiek County, really, or we didn't really look beyond the Quad. I mean, everything was there. And the people who taught us made us feel like we were the only people in the world. I mean, it's funny because I'm going, my 25th reunion is coming up, and I'm going to see the man who is entirely responsible for my historical career, Dan Kaiser, this Saturday. And, he's taught there his whole life, and God love him. I think about my own teaching, and it just doesn't measure up. I don't think it can, given the obligations that I have, but it's a very different experience, I would say that. Well, why don't we move on then and talk about the graduate experience in the 1960s. I was fascinated to read in all of the memoirs about the good, bad, and sometimes ugly experiences that people had in graduate school. John, do you want to go first?
Well, yes. Of course, it didn't come as a surprise to us because we had already thought through this problem. But it was rather astonishing to see how this was replicated in almost every case, except Reese Isaac, who never did a graduate degree.
Exactly.
he was blissfully saved from this. And I think his wonderful work reflects that. There were still people like Lawrence Stone in our environment who had never taken a PhD. Mm-hmm. We need to reflect on that a little bit.
It's Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember at Rutgers, I tried to hire John Keegan, the great military historian. My colleagues asked, well, could he possibly, he doesn't have a PhD, could he teach our graduate students? This is a man who every graduate student read and admired. Could he teach them? Yes. But to get back to this, more general point. The level of disappointment, chagrin, and maybe even revulsion that was often felt is, of course, has to be set against the kind of nostalgia that is often surrounds the 50s and 60s in some circles as the great days, of the great men teaching, in those days. So I think our book is a wonderful kind of counter to some of the myths about the early days of graduate education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jim?
Well, I reflect on it as John does, but with a few additions, and I'm certain if he had more time, he'd add plenty to it also. I think that by the time you're 21 or 2 and you're dropped out of the collegiate warmth into the cold bath of graduate education, you're much more of an adult than when you were 18 years old and matriculating as a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
You're ready to move on as an adult, and you're still dependent. And in my case, I was 3 years older, having just gotten out of 3 year service in the Army, as Dwight Pitt Cathley, another of our authors, had. He eventually served in Vietnam. And suddenly we were in graduate school, and we were being told what to do, how we were expected to do it. We were at marriageable age. We wanted to have lives of our own. And so I think that we probably, and I'm certain this is the case with surgeons-to-be and attorneys-to-be, we felt a great sense of limitation, of restraint, of being perimetered. And so we were sort of prepared to be aggravated every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to be released to be finished with our courses, take our exams, do our dissertations, and get on with our work life. But in addition to that, as John says, the conditions of graduate education were not good, and they had not been fully thought through. In fact, We don't have to discuss this this afternoon, but I remain quite a sharp critic of the way we're preparing, or in my view, not adequately preparing graduate students, at least in history, even today. But certainly our graduate preparation, our graduate programs are far better organized, are somewhat more humane, are much more self-conscious than they were when John and I were in graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, I look back on my graduate days at Berkeley, and I was pretty much at sea. One of the difficulties I faced was that, again, I wanted to go, you know, my object was to go to graduate school to become a history teacher. I thought I might write an article or two, and that was pretty much it. And when I was thrown into that environment, which was very competitive there, I was just really at sea. I was surrounded by people who I felt were much better prepared because they had gone to institutions that had had graduate programs. I mean, one of you mentioned, I think, in your essays, I can't remember which, that you had never met a graduate student or seen a graduate student before you got to graduate school, and I never had either. I didn't know what they were, really. And then the idea that, you know, and in my first semester that I was asked to be a TA in Western Civ was shocking to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know anything as far as I was concerned.
It may have been shocking to the undergraduates.
Yeah, I didn't know anything, and there I was in the classroom teaching for somebody, and it was really kind of very strange to me. I would say that I had quite a bit of difficulty in those first few years, and I think a lot of people do, particularly if they come from a liberal arts background, because they don't really have the chops to do it. And that's why today so many people that go to graduate school in history, I can't speak for other disciplines, are the sons and daughters of professors. Yeah. They have the chops. They know what to do.
Well, John, you've noticed that.
We should talk about, because one of the things that bothers me, actually, about the current generation is not only the hyper-professionalism, but also the nepotism that one sees. I don't mean corrupt nepotism, but I mean it's this verdure cultural capitalism, cultural capital that so many of these sons and daughters bring with them, which gives them an enormous leg up, but at the same time is a kind of ball and chain around their leg, and one sees that all the time as well. I'm reminded a little bit of Gerald Graff once wrote an article about how he was introduced to research. He's a well-known literary scholar. And he said when his graduate mentors said, well, now it's time for you to go off and do some research, he didn't know what that meant, and it panicked him. It took him a few weeks of skulking around the library before he became confident of what that was. And I think that was very much part of our generation. One of the great benefits of arriving so unprepared in graduate school and being, in many cases, alienated by the environment we found is we developed, and Jim just pointed this out, a very sturdy independence, which allowed us then to reinvent ourselves as scholars, sometimes several times over. So not being beholden to our graduate mentors as much, perhaps, as some are today, we were able to go on and do some things that, in retrospect, I think we can be quite proud of.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a danger of losing something that our teachers' generation and our own, to some degree, had, and that it was a breadth of family and socioeconomic experiences. I mean, a lot of my teachers were sons of the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
They would probably have stayed and gone into some form of commerce or something like that in the Midwest or the East or wherever, and yet they had the opportunity, because of federal support after their service in the war or right after it, to go to graduate school and to do something of their choice. But they'd been out. They'd fought in a war. They'd been in other parts of the country. They'd come from families of a different sort. And what with these days, in fact, the last 3 or 4 or 5 days, we have heard concerns about the Supreme Court being ingrown and all of its members being circuit court judges raised up to the high bench. I think that's part of the danger now that, at least in history, that so much of its population of teacher professors will be the same cultural and socioeconomic class, and they'll be a declining proportion of people coming in, as it were, from the wings, from different sectors of society,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is one of the reasons why it's critically important always to hire and promote and bring through the ranks people who, from groups who haven't yet gotten there. Mm-hmm. You think now of Latinos, American Indians, and still African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I quite agree with that. It's funny you mentioned the Supreme Court, because my wife and I over breakfast this morning were being here in the Midwest. We have a kind of chip on our shoulder in the sense that we looked up where all of the Supreme Court justices were from. I mean, first of all, they all went to two law schools. We know that.
Yes.
Just two law schools. That's it. And we won't name them, but I bet everybody can guess. There's no Supreme Court justice from west of the Mississippi to the California coast.
It would be very interesting to run a similar test on the population of historians who are 60 years old and then those who are, say, 40 years old,
yes.
and see what differences we'd find.
Yeah,
but
in our book, it should be said, we have some stories that are quite revealing of other kinds of experiences. Maureen Nutting's essay. She graduated from Catholic schools in New York City, mm-hmm. went to Fordham, then went to Notre Dame, is really revelatory in what happens when you move up within a Catholic cultural and educational system. And Dwight Pakathley's tale of his entry into the position of head historian of the National Park Service is another really quite revealing story of a different path taken and the consequences of that. So it's not it's true. Most of our authors went to these sort of obvious important places of higher education, but there are other stories mixed in that are really in many ways the best part of the book.
Mm-hmm. I would say that in my own experience, I don't have any statistics on this, but just having served on search committees and things like this, that the quality of applicants that we get from schools that are not traditionally prestigious is very high now. I mean, we just hired a really terrific guy who got his PhD at Northern Illinois. And he's just great, and he was up against all your standards. Sort of Berkeleys and Yales and Stanfords and so on and so forth. But so the level of graduate education, I think, in these departments is now much higher than it ever was, and I think that's probably good for the profession in that sense.
It is the major unrecognized benefit of the job crisis of the 70s and 80s,
yeah.
that people who did not get into the prestigious public and private universities and colleges ended up at less prestigious ones developing graduate courses and finding themselves teaching graduate students who were just about as good, if not every bit as good, as the ones who were at Berkeley and Harvard.
Yeah, well, this guy
that's been better for us all.
I don't mean to go on and on, I won't mention his name, but this guy has a very interesting history, which much recommends him. He's Norwegian. He moved, for whatever reason, I don't know, to Alabama, where he went to, I think, Southern Alabama or something, I don't even know where. Then he got married to somebody from Alabama, and they moved to Illinois, where he went to Northern Illinois, and he, of all things, decided to study American Indians in the 17th century. That's my kind of guy right there.
Very interesting.
He has all kinds of background to bring to it.
We want more of those.
Yeah, I think we do want more of those.
Well, it should be said, for example, that the whole global history movement, which I believe is the most creative and vital part of our profession today, found no starting point in any of the major graduate schools. In fact, most of the major graduate schools do not teach global history.
No, they don't.
And it's public history, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And public history is another. So people either went sideways into this or began to develop courses and curricula and MA programs at even community colleges have done far better, not even. Community colleges have been more creative in the field of global history mm-hmm. than any of the major 20 graduate universities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this causes for, I think our book might be the cause of a little reflection on all of these issues.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I'm a big fan of world history myself. I taught I directed, I guess is the right word, a National Endowment for the Humanities, I think it was 4 or 6 week long symposium on Eurasia as a unit in world history.
Oh, good.
And it was great. And it was chock-a-block with community college teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could get anybody else to come. So, because nobody else taught world history. So I was, it was nice of the NEH to sponsor that. I want to talk about one thing, though, that does, in a certain sense, differentiate your experience from mine. And that is and this comes through in most of the essays, that is the political engagement at the time, and not just political engagement in your kind of standard civil rights movement, that kind of thing, but the force which was social history in the 1960s, that everybody confronted it, and that it provided a kind of a vital center for all of the careers that are dealt with in the essays. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I could start. To be a young historian, at least in those days, was to be not so much a part of a profession as part of a movement. And you really felt that you were on sort of quaking ground, and it was good quaking ground. In other words, it was thrusting you forward into a world that was relevant, one that was connected to public events, no matter whether you're on the left or the right. This idea of making a real contribution to the world at large was very palpable in that period. And it was something of an illusion, but nevertheless, it's something that I try to convey to younger people today, and I can see the blankness come into their eyes, because there's nothing like that today for most of them. They are highly professional, very able, but they do not feel connected to one another, much less the world as a part of any kind of movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jim?
Well, John and I differ in this regard. I mean, not intellectually, and we wouldn't have an argument about it, but our experience differs and ourselves differ. John's a little bit younger than I am, and he felt the social batterings, or the batterings of the external world, no more deeply than I did, but it had a different effect on him. Being 3 or 4 years older and having served for 3 years in the Army, whereas, for example, I could be as stiff as John and most of my colleagues and friends in opposing the Vietnam War, I could never take up the banners and march down the street against the Army, the Navy, the Marines, and the Coast Guard, say, Air Force, because I'd served in the Army and I knew what Army service was like and what people in the Army, particularly professional soldiers and officers, were trying to accomplish and achieve. And so I didn't join in the work of history as a movement. I remained a political and institutional historian and have been so all my life and have loved it. But I did feel it in what I did, as John tried to do at Princeton, and then after Princeton with John at Rutgers, altering the undergraduate curriculum, making the university more responsive to young people, trying to teach courses that were, as we used to say in those days, ad nauseum relevant, trying to, in the case of Princeton, make it a coeducational university, which it became in 1968 and 9, and so on. So in that sense, I was part of the movement, but not intellectually and not opening new fields of historical inquiry as John and people about 5 years younger than I started to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you mentioned actually a good point. I would also like to see the statistic on how many historians of my generation and later have either military experience themselves or have relatives within, say, two removes that have had any military experience.
Well, it's interesting because I've done a modest count of my college class. There were about 1,000 of us, and I think about a third of us served in some branch of the military. Yeah. A few people made careers of officership in the services, but most of them served, either were drafted or served for 6 months or went into ROTC or officer's candidate school, or like myself, volunteered for the draft. There were all sorts of routes into service, but it was, let us not vaunt my generation, it was a time of peace.
Mm-hmm.
There was the draft, which was an impulse to make a choice of a service and arm and so on, but there was also the fact that the world was at peace, and so that you could volunteer for the draft and have a pretty good chance of coming out unscathed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it's quite true. I just was, you know, wondering about this. We have a lot at Iowa, particularly. We have a lot of people in ROTC. Somebody actually wrote an editorial in the Chronicle of Higher Education recently that the thesis of which was something like bring back ROTC. And I just thought to myself, where does this guy live? Because here in the Midwest, it doesn't need to be brought back because it's all over the place.
It left the private colleges and universities. You don't find it at Yale. You don't find it at Columbia. Yeah. You don't find it at Harvard.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that's true. But here, you know, they have actually a lot of students. I taught a course in military history that had 3 Iraq veterans in it. So, yeah, that was quite an entertaining thing.
Well, I think it should be said, though, that Jim's experience carried over into his career as a public historian. And I think that needs to be noted that might be an interesting area to explore. How many of the public historians have been the product of military service, Peace Corps, and so on?
Yeah,
that's another interesting bridge for historians.
Yeah. I want to go back to just a second to social history and sort of the new left. And this is something I very much admired when I was in college in the 1980s and then in graduate school in the late 1980s. And I sort of looked back on it with rose-colored glasses. I wish that was still around. But what I found when I got to graduate school was, you know, the old saying about first time tragedy, second time farce, was a great commitment to Michel Foucault that I confess I just found bewildering. I mean, with all due respect to Joan Wallach Scott, who writes eloquently and uses this stuff, we really were force-fed a lot of that stuff. And I never really could kind of figure out why, but still it was somehow, people were inspired by it. I wasn't so much inspired by it because I think I just didn't really understand it. But I know that there was an attempt to kind of gin it up in a way to kind of make it somehow politically relevant, but I never could figure out exactly how it was politically relevant. Maybe that's my own limitation.
You're reflecting your generational position, because what you were encountering really is the cultural turn, and most social historians that got going in the 60s and early 70s never took that turn very seriously, or have always managed to keep their boots on the ground in some ways, as I see it. Now there are two distinct things going on here. The social history movement was sometimes extraordinarily mundane, actually, in its insistence on treating the ordinary, the everyday. It rarely rose to the level of conceptualization that you're talking about. So, it was a little bit theory averse, actually.
I know what you mean. Just one anecdote. I remember, it was 1992, and I had just gotten back from the Soviet Union. I had done some archival research there, and I was teaching at a big graduate program, to go unnamed, a very prestigious big graduate program. And the graduate students said they were going to have a seminar, kind of an impromptu seminar on methodology. And I thought, this was kind of interesting. I'm going to go to this seminar and just tell them what I learned in the archive. And I get there, and you know, they're talking about method. And sort of one after another of them starts talking about Foucault and Derrida and Lyotard and, I don't know, these other things. And I remember thinking to myself, my method is to go look at old documents and try to figure out what they say. And then, you know, sort of unreconstructed empiricism is sort of fallen by the wayside. I will say this, though, in defense of my discipline and all of those people, that when they actually come to write books, and I know this now because I read a lot of history books as a result of doing this show, that there's very little of that. That it all really does come down to read some documents and figure out what happened. And
My impression and my experience is that historians are incredibly consistent in what they actually do.
I agree completely.
Day to day, in the classroom and in writing.
Yeah.
And that is one of the great strengths of our profession, which accounts for the degree to which we haven't been riven and destroyed by the kind of internal conflicts that you find in anthropology, mm-hmm. in English, and in other fields.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I agree completely. And again, you know, there's a great difference between the theory of graduate training and the practice of graduate training, because I went through these courses where I had to read all this French and sort of Marxist sort of social theory, and then when I actually got to the research stage, it turned out to be quite an exercise in, again, deconstructed empiricism.
But don't sell it short. It's all right in some respects that that you do it and that it is done. But it does, reading that and talking about it and arguing about it with others does create a sensibility,
mm-hmm.
which has affected, I think, probably even social and political and institutional history. It gives you a certain way of reading documents additional to those that we had before. Mm-hmm. We had read Foucault and Lyotard and the others. And I think that's all to the good, because it's opened up possibilities of understanding that we didn't have before. But it is also to the good, as you yourself point out, Marshall, that you don't find every page of every book of history interlarded with all these theoretical concepts and continental theories.
Yeah, you really don't, and that's a good thing. And I read a lot of history books, and there's very little of that, even in the introduction. There's very little of that kind of boilerplate. But you know, I just point out that there are certain fad is probably too strong a word, but there are certain fashions, I don't know what to call them, that come and go, and I'm interested in my own life to see this one kind of come and perhaps go now. Let's move on then in our review of historical careers to talk about, and this is going to be the most entertaining part, I think, for the listeners, especially if they are historians of my generation and after, the job acquisition process. There are some really amazing sentences in these memoirs about that. Maybe you could talk about your own experiences.
Well, I was one of those people who got hired over the phone by Princeton, and which was a kind of act, a miracle act. I didn't reflect much on it at the time, except to praise the heavens. But now I can see that it was not a system that really was appropriate. I don't think I would recommend it, certainly not. In fact, I've been a staunch advocate of proper procedures and affirmative action ever since. But some of the stories in our book will astonish the younger generation.
It was a time in which jobs were plentiful, in which 99.9% of the faculty members at teaching and graduate programs were men. So one man would call another and say, "Who are your best men?"
Mm-hmm.
And John's advisor said John Gillis. My advisor said Jim Banner. And I drove from Westchester County, or from north of New York, to Princeton and had my interview in person. John was on the West Coast, and his was conducted by phone. The degree was an interview. But those were the days of patronage and of small graduate programs. That changed within 10 years, and all for the better. It's made it much more difficult on departments when they have to make decisions and hire people because of the huge flow of applications that come in.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it turns out to be decently, modestly more meritocratic.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the diaspora of talent, of scholarly and perhaps teaching talent throughout the entire system of American higher education, including community colleges, that we find today. And that's a great gain for the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did It has passed out of existence to some extent, but I do remember even in the late 80s, and I was teaching at another one of those very prestigious programs, and a senior faculty member, probably of your generation, was overheard to say, when I need to hire somebody, I get a list of the recent Princeton graduates. So, yes. And I suspect it's an efficient way to do it in the sense that it happens quickly. But I wanted to talk about something else, though, and I'd really be interested to hear your opinion on this, and that is that it doesn't come up in the book, but I think it's important to talk about, and that is that while I would credit your generation for professionalizing history in the sense that the product of the graduate programs that you all set up is much higher than I would even say your own generation. That is, the quality of historical work, and certainly its volume, has improved tremendously over the past 40 or 50 years. But on the other hand, I do think that, and I want to hear your opinion about this, that graduate programs and perhaps even people of your generation have done a great a disservice to would-be historians by accepting so many of them into graduate school and producing so many PhDs when we know that they'll never get jobs. I happen to know the statistics here just because I constantly try to convince people not to go to graduate school in history. Half of the people that enter graduate programs in history don't finish now. Of those, 25% actually get teaching jobs, and then some portion of that actually ever get tenure. So it's somewhere around sort of 15 and 20% of the people who get PhDs in history now or start the programs actually end up teaching. And I know that I personally have, I would say, at least a dozen, and I probably could name more, of people that I was in graduate school with sort of on 5 years either side of me who are no longer in the field. They got PhDs and left because they couldn't find jobs anywhere.
Well, Marshall, let's keep all of this in context. I can think of many people who entered graduate school with me who disappeared, didn't finish or finished and disappeared. They certainly didn't make any mark as scholars or as participants in the discipline. Second of all, notice the way you have put this, as most people still would. They didn't get teaching jobs.
Mm-hmm.
At least 50% of the people who come out of our graduate programs per annum now don't want teaching jobs. They're seeking jobs in what, for better or for worse, is known as public history.
Mm-hmm.
So a much higher proportion of people than you mention are getting jobs as historians, but they're not getting jobs, some of them don't want jobs, as academic historians. But they're serving as historians in museums, in historical societies, in state humanities councils, in government. They go on to get law degrees, as a couple of my students do, and retain a deep interest in history and try to participate as historians on the side when and if they can, and so on. One of the problems with the discipline, and particularly the American Historical Association and our departments, from which John and I got our degrees, Stanford and Columbia, they don't do anything to keep up with the students, those who hold degrees, who didn't go into the academy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we really don't know enough about them, but I'm certain that your figures are too low.
Okay, John?
No, I'm glad that Jim brought this up, and of course he's deeply involved in this and has looked at it and actually promotes public history. So it's a good corrective. It's a very good corrective. I suppose you could say that we're as guilty as the Democrats and the Republicans in ascribing to a free market economy. And it would be very difficult to get our profession to regulate itself in the way that has sometimes been done with quotas in Europe on different fields.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the hope of going beyond the market model in our profession is pretty low, and the whole idea is, in America, is second chances and third chances.
Mm-hmm.
So if people end up having satisfying lives pursuing history in various venues, well, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
What can one say?
No, I take that point, and it's a good one. I guess I would only say in response that, again, this is my own personal experience, that people that I know entered the academy wanting to become professors. And I wouldn't say that they don't have meaningful lives. In fact, some of them are filthy rich right now. I can think of some of my graduate school cohort who are just, you know, on top of the world. But, you know, they were disappointed when they found out that 100 other people had applied for that job at, you know, a college in Idaho, and that their chances of getting it were, you know, extraordinarily low no matter what they did. This is a cause of, I think, some generational conflict. And I really see a sort of difference between the way you guys see it and the way people of my cohort and later. You know, I have graduate students now, and I one of the great things about the Iowa department is we accept extraordinarily few students. And we support them all the way through, and we don't virtually guarantee them jobs, but we just work our tails off to make sure that they get them.
That's wonderful, but I suspect too, and here is where I am a critic of our graduate programs, that very little is done. I can't think of the right word. Let me use the word to counter-acculturate. That's not quite right.
Yes.
Graduate students to the professorial ideal.
Mm-hmm.
They walk into the classroom. They see these older and deeply respected and sometimes nationally renowned writers and historians standing in front of the classroom or around the seminar table, and they say to themselves, that's what I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Those professors never set them at odds with that. It's a noble aspiration. I don't want to be mistaken in what I'm saying,
mm-hmm.
but there are plenty of ways to be a historian, and unless you grab the graduate students right from the beginning and say, look, you're stuck with me as a professor because professors give graduate degrees, but there are a lot of ways to be historians in addition to being a professor.
Mm-hmm.
It would really help. Very few of our graduate programs do that, and if they do it, they sort of move a few people off who are not going to be considered the best graduate students into these
mm-hmm.
public history tracks and so on. That's
mm-hmm.
not the way to do it. Everybody should be prepared equally to be all kinds mm-hmm. of historians. It's not being done.
Then
we wouldn't have the employment crisis and the overabundance of graduate students to the degree that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. No, I see what you mean. You were going to say, John?
Well, I was going to say that the great shortfall of our generation has been not to confront the very silent and devastating restructuring of universities that began really in the, I would say, in the 80s and continued in the 90s up to today.
Yes.
And that is the shift away from full-time employment to part-time employment, the shift from, small administrations and large faculties to large administrations and small faculties.
Mm.
I mean, there's a lot of politics that frankly, our generation should have engaged in on this issue, and that's as much a part of the problem as anything we're describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I do quite agree with you that there's simply no way to tell faculties not to accept so many graduate students, and people are going to go if they think they have any chance at all because they think the prize is a very good one, and it is a very good one in many ways. I did want to mention in regard to Jim's point that I think one of the reasons that you don't see graduate advisors in history departments explaining what other options are available is because they don't know. I will tell you this. I am, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I am the only history professor that I know, and I know hundreds of history professors who has ever left the discipline and come back.
Yes.
Can you name one?
I
can't name any.
Well, I can think of two, but not in our generation.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen. If you leave, you're not going to be asked back. It's not, in other words, it's not seen as an advantage that you went out into the real world and have done something. That's an impediment to your further career. If you come off the track, you don't get to go back on. And that is really pretty much incomprehensible to me. Because I, you know, in my advising, and I'm the director of undergraduate advisors here, I spend most of my days trying to figure out what undergraduate history majors are going to do with their lives. And they come to me and they say, yeah, I want to be a high school teacher. And that's a great thing. That's a great thing to be. But they don't know that there are 100 other things they could do with
mm-hmm.
history degrees. And the only reason I know is because I worked in a corporation for 5 years.
Because you've done it.
Yeah, right. I did it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I left academia and I had a job. And, you know, I put on my slacks and button-down shirt and went and sat in a cubicle. And I loved it. it was great. I had really, you know, I had a really terrific time working for the corporation, and all the historical skills that I had gained were very valuable to me. But I mean, I think that the fact of the matter is that we've kind of trained a cohort, for better or worse, of people that are extraordinarily good at something very narrow. It's kind of cliche to say, but it's true. So when they come to advise, you know, people about what they might do with their lives, they just don't. They don't really know. They don't have the experience that is necessary, in order to kind of relay what might be done. And I think that's a great. It's a great tragedy. And I don't think that any amount of help from the career placement program is going to change that. And I don't see is there any fix for it.
So it occurs to me as you're speaking that we're stuck with a 19th century metaphor. The track, in other words, railway technology for 21st century dilemma.
Right.
I mean, the tenure track is a kind of bizarre idea when you think about it. It might be the tenure maze, but or the net. That might be the better metaphor for today.
So let me ask you this: where do you see? We've taken up a lot of your time. Obviously, I have a couple more questions. Though one of them is, where do you see graduate education going now, and where do you see the profession going?
Well, that's difficult to say. It's treading water right now. I don't see any initiatives in the places that I inhabit on the West Coast or the East Coast. So in that sense, it's treading water. There's some movement in some directions, like global history. Where it should go, well, I think we discussed some of them. I think it should reach out. I think, for example, we should get historians to think of themselves again as writers, open up that part of our discipline, which has been rather submerged. That might be a possibility. I don't know.
It's funny, if I could just interject there, it's funny you mentioned that, because one of the things I'm toying with doing is trying to start an MA program for people that want to write history for popular audiences. You know, we have the writer's program here, so we have a certain amount we can build on. But I know that a lot of my students, you know, they have a desire to write for popular audiences, and I do. You know, one of the things, if I might so say, that's missing in a way from your book is people that write, I guess what we'd call, well, they write history outside the academy, and I interview a lot of them, and their history books are very good, and they're very readable, and these are people that make a living writing history books. I interviewed a guy just last week who, you know, he that's what he does for a living, and, you know, I'm sure that he's not a rich man, but he certainly is able to put food on the table with it, and
admiration for that, and, you know, in the field of writing now, there's a major category called creative nonfiction, and why shouldn't we embrace that?
Yeah.
And you at Iowa could, I think you could make some very interesting bridges across that category called creative nonfiction.
Well, it depends upon how creative. Now, we don't want to go and create characters. That's what Morris does
in his
study of Ronald Reagan. That was very creative. He made up a figure out of whole cloth.
Right. No,
remember, it's nonfiction, Jim.
That's right. That wasn't nonfiction.
I agree with you completely. From your mouth to the chancellor's ears. That's what I say. So, Jim, do you have a feeling on where things are going?
No, I don't. I agree entirely with John. I think that we're sort of in a period of stasis, and the question is, it's going to be interesting to see how it works out, whether the impulse for any change, any movement, any shift is going to come from within the discipline of history or within the academy or from some outside, some external political or public or cultural events.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can tell you that this podcast was started precisely to bring the work of professional historians such as yourself to wider audiences, and that I think we have done to some extent, because I think that it is important that we do speak to public issues. A lot of the history books that are, you know, monographic in character are actually very readable and very interesting, and it's unfortunate they cost $55.
Well, it's unfortunate that they cost $55, but it's also unfortunate that too many people believe that history or mathematics or literature or biology somehow should be gained by no work. It should all be easy, and I think it's very important for all of us to require certain levels of labor on the part of our fellow citizens in order to gain knowledge of their world, present and past. We give them too easy a pass. I think all of us, we work hard. You have to work hard to be a citizen, and you have to work hard to be informed, and you have to work hard to learn, something that I always told my students, I always told my children, and I always remind myself that learning to understand things takes hard work.
Yeah, no disagreement here. I know that I worked hard. Yes, absolutely. Definitely. So let me thank you both for being on the show. And we have a traditional final question here in New Books in History, and that is, what are your respective final, certainly won't be final, what are your next projects? John, why don't you start?
Well, in 2004, I published a book called Islands of the Mind, which was an exploration of the imaginative geographies of islands in world history, and now
it's a wonderful book.
Well, what is the name? What is the name of it? Pitch it.
It's called Islands of the Mind.
Islands of the Mind.
Islands of the Mind.
Okay.
And now I am launched in an even more grotesquely ambitious project on coasts in human history, and I'm looking through the lens once again of culture. To ask the question, how have coasts changed over time, not only in a material sense, but in a cultural sense of the meaning of coasts to human culture and the long and forgotten history of coastal peoples throughout the world. So once again, I hope this will be a book that will reach a public because our coasts are, of course, as we all know, an endangered area, and we as coastal people are an endangered species. So this is an attempt to recover that long history and some of the lessons that it provides.
So you're going to start the littoralist school.
The littoralist.
There you go. You need a brand. You know, one of the things I learned in the corporation is you need a brand name for anything you do. You got to have a tag for it. Littoralism. I can see it now. You know.
I hope it will grab the heartland. Yes.
Jim, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on completing a book that's tentatively called Becoming a Historian, and it really is a preface to being a historian today. I think people who have heard this program will recognize that I'm concerned about the way in which we prepare young people to become professional historians of all kinds, and this is a kind of introduction to how you can become so and what you have to think about when you're making the decisions as to what you will do as a historian. After that, I'm giving serious consideration to writing a book, largely for popular consumption, on revising history, trying to answer the question that's been so mooted politically, particularly by those who sneer at revisionism, to what historians try to do when they write history and why historical interpretations change, under what circumstances, to what end, why do historians differ from each other, why do they argue with each other, why do they take issue with their own culture, and so on. It's trying to lay all that out in, I would hope, brief and lucid fashion so that anybody who's interested in those questions can find out something that they may not have known.
Mm-hmm. Well, I both those projects sound absolutely terrific, and when you complete them, please call me, and we will have you on the show again. I should tell our listeners that today we've been talking to John Gillis and Jim Banner about their terrific new book, which is a series of memoirs by historians called Becoming Historians. It's just appeared from the University of Chicago Press. Is that right, the University of Chicago Press?
Yes, that's right.
And
in paperback.
And it's in paperback, so you can get it. I highly recommend that that everybody, especially if you're in the historical discipline or thinking about entering the historical discipline, read it, because it is a terrific read to hear these historians talk about themselves and their careers. And I want to thank both of you guys, John and Jim, for being on the show.
Well, thanks, Marshall.
Thank you, Marshall.
Teaching again.
All right. Absolutely my pleasure. You guys take care now.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Jim Banner and John Gillis about their new book, Becoming Historians. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.